Do you need to turn the machine on?
Yeah.
It's on.
Oh, it's on?
It's on.
Roll it. Take two.
Peter Jackson here from New Zealand.
I love it.
So I'm going to do number 5 on the notes on page 2, but then 6, 7, and 8 I've covered already as a result of answering Chris's question or trying to answer. I just want to make sure that it became a bit of a mess on the board. And I wondered, I had this extremely neat diagram, and then I started drawing arrows all over the place. So I just want to make sure that those arrows are not confusing people. But number 5, first of all, this account of potency form and act covers any possible scientific explanation. And we'll see rules in canons, rather, when he refers to canons of metaphysical equivalence in the next chapter, of how you can transform scientific explanations into their metaphysical equivalents. But it covers any of them, and so it fits the understanding of science presented earlier in the book, and we saw that when Chris was teasing out that this is the whole thing of classical statistical laws. For a scientific explanation is a theory verified in instances. As theory, it's understandable. As verified, it's affirmed, it's act. As in instances, it's importance of the individuality. We have treated, or will treat in the book, 3 kinds of scientific theory. This is a Lonergan statement now, and I'm going to add one point to it. I wrote it in my notes today, going over this again. Classical theory, the classical science, refers to form as form, the relations of things to one another, the elements of things to one another, form as form. Statistical theory refers to form as setting ideal frequencies from which departures take place, but not systematically. And those departures are acts, occurrences, and this is another loop on this theory. Those occurrences as non-systematic departures become potency for the emergence of new form. So act as non-systematic occurrence is also potency for the emergence of new form. So it's not like act and potency are not necessarily completely discrete, because act can be a non-systematic occurrence, which becomes potentiality for the emergence of a new form. So act becomes potency in that sense. There's an ongoing developmental notion here. Classical theory then form as form. Statistical theory is form as setting ideal frequencies from which acts, occurrences, do not diverge systematically. And then genetic theory, which we'll see in the material to be discussed next week, the second half of the chapter, refers to the conditions of the emergence of form from potency. Now, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that he discusses yet one further type of heuristic structure, namely dialectical. And that's what I just want to add here, if you want to write it in, that the dialectical heuristic structure pertains to the ontology of meaning. So there is not dialectic in nature itself, in what is known by the natural sciences. The dialectic is in human affairs, and it pertains to the ontology of meaning. So there will be dialectical differences, the true and the false, the good and the evil, and so on and so forth, but those are in the realm of the human realm of meaning and value. Okay, the rest of it, I think, 6, 7, and 8, I'm not going to go into, because I think I'm done responding to Chris's question. So if we can jump to number 9 here. Section 3 is entitled Explanatory Genera and Species, and that will raise, for most of you, a reminiscence of things that were discussed in the chapter on things in Chapter 8. But it begins to show how this outline enables an integration of the sciences. It recasts, in section 3 of this chapter, recasts what chapter 8 said about gender and species in terms of conjugate and central potency, form, and act. The recasting is in terms of that. And it goes like this. Different combinations, this is an example of how it would work. Different combinations of subatomic conjugate forms define explanatorily, in an explanatory way, subatomic things. These may differ specifically. You can have many different types of subatomic things, whatever you want to call them. Since the forms systematize differently the occurrence of acts, but they all belong to the same genus, subatomic. Different combinations of the verified correlations yield a range of schemes of recurrence which systematize the conjugate acts at this level of generic differentiation. So that's just at that particular level. But there may be occurrences, chemical occurrences, that are not in these schemes and so are random, coincidental. Now, potency. These may become systematic form, and they become systematic or in form, but not in such a way as to be accounted for by the previous subatomic schemes. There's the emergence of a new form. Then a new set of conjugate forms, chemical, to be known by the science of chemistry, has emerged, defining a new genus of things, namely the chemical elements, and later the chemical compounds, and yielding a new range of schemes of recurrence that make systematic the new type of acts. We have questions now about Mars as a result of these explorations that are going on in Mars. How far has this evolved there from the subatomic to the chemical, definitely? No question about that. But how much further? That's really what the question is all about. Have there been at least random occurrences of life that are potency for form, scheme, system, not accounted for by chemical schemes, defining a new genus and yielding a new range of schemes, making systematic the new acts? That's exactly the question that they're asking with the Mars exploration today. Is there evidence that there have been random occurrences of life that perhaps may even have become schematic and systematized? And so there may have been living things, possibly. Random occurrences of consciousness in what previously was simply a plant world of life. Random occurrences of consciousness, however rudimentary that consciousness may be, will be potency for form not accounted for by botanical schemes. Defining a new genus, animal, and yielding a new range of schemes, systematizing new acts. And a manifold of conjugate acts thus becomes a conjugate potency for a higher systematization by form, yielding new things of new gene. So it's a whole putting into a metaphysical schema of that whole succession of generic and specific emergence that we discussed in chapter 8. The lower things do not survive in the higher things. But the lower conjugate potencies, forms, and acts do, systematized by the higher forms. The same data under the totality of their aspects cannot be the data for different things. If any datum under all its aspects pertains to one thing, then it does not pertain to any other thing. Hence, if there is a higher thing, there are data for affirming it, and the same data are not data for any other thing. It is to be noted, however, that we're not speaking here of bodies, but of things. Obviously, within the body of an animal, there can be many different things. And he's talking about what you appropriate to the animal as belonging to it, and what you appropriate to the different things that might be within the body. But these different things are not the animal nor parts of it. They may be foreign bodies, they may live in symbiosis with the animal, but they do not pertain to the animal as do its eyes and other organs. The lower things don't survive, but the lower conjugate forms and so on that we saw earlier on. Now, the integration of the sciences. Pertaining to the successive genera, there will be distinct and autonomous sciences. Physics, chemistry, botany, the whole realm of biological sciences, psychology, study of the human person, study of human society and human culture and so on, without any logical process from one to the other, so that one could be reduced to the other or deduced from the other. You can't reduce chemistry to physics. You cannot deduce chemistry from physics. You can't reduce biology to chemistry, nor can you deduce biology from chemistry. There isn't that kind of logical connection. They are related, but they're related as successive higher viewpoints, where the symbolic denotation of the coincidental manifolds of lower conjugate acts, whatever your scientific symbolic denotation of that might be, are images for insight into laws relating higher forms. Those images are really heuristic. They're not painting a picture. They facilitate the transition from one science to another. They're not representations of things as they are, as though the real were a subdivision of the already out there now and so on. He's just trying to get the images. You can do all kinds of manipulation of images in order to help insight emerge. Don't claim that the image is a picture of what it looks like. That's not the function of an image in science. The function of an image in science is to provide the material in which insight can be had. If they were representations of things as they are, then the successive higher viewpoints would be subjective additions by intelligence. This is what he's trying to get away from. There is an objective ground for this succession of sciences and for a non-reductionistic understanding of the sciences. So that you can't reduce a human being to an animal to a plant to a chemical compound to subatomic particles. They are not reducible. That's enough for number 11. And then we take 12, and then we get 12, and then we can pause. This account of the sciences, he says, has a high, in fact, he says, unique probability. And that is sufficient for a metaphysics that is nuanced. Because he says metaphysics is not going to have the same degree of certainty at every point. All right. So this account of the sciences, so that you've got physics, chemistry, the biological sciences, the psychological sciences, the human sciences related to one another in this way, has a high or unique probability. It may have no doubt about central and conjugate potencies formed in act, yet it can be content with unique probability when it comes to differentiating the explanatory genera and species of form. What does he mean by unique probability? A conception is uniquely probable if it meets an issue fairly and squarely and there are no available alternative views. That's what he's maintaining, that, you know, this is the best you're going to find right now. The notion of the succession of higher viewpoints would seem to be the one and only manner in which logically unrelated sciences can be unified. The notion that lower coincidental manifolds of occurrences are systematized by higher forms would seem to be the one and only way in which higher orders of reality can be immanent in the lower orders without violating the lower classical laws. And then 467, page 467, he raises the question of fact. Are there in this universe things that differ specifically and generically, where these differences are conceived not descriptively but explanatorily? If one is to revise any judgment, so a little bit of an ellipsis here because I left some stuff out. If one is to revise any judgment, one must appeal to experience, understanding, and judgment. And so the person who's revising it will be a concrete and intelligible unity of empirical, intelligent, and rational consciousness. Moreover, one must make one's pronouncement, not while one is conscious within the biological, aesthetic, artistic, dramatic, or practical patterns of experience. They have their place, but it's not the place for this kind of thing. But rather, while one is conscious within the intellectual pattern. Still, you and I are capable of experience in those other patterns, or in some blend or alternation of them, for otherwise, I wouldn't be a human being. If the only pattern of experience in which I functioned was the intellectual pattern, I would not be a human being. Human being is a polymorphic complex of all of these patterns. So it will, I will be capable of experiencing those other patterns, and it follows that the hypothetical revisor, let's say myself, if he is a human being, will be more than a concrete and intelligible human being of empirical, intelligent, and rational consciousness. This is partly definitive of who I am. What else will he or she be? One has to invoke at least one other genus of conjugate forms, namely the animal genus, in order to grasp some of these other dimensions of consciousness, the sensitive, the aesthetic, even the aesthetic, huh, because it's based in sensitivity. There's something more than simply this desire to know that's operative in us. To account for the concrete possibility of other patterns of experience, to account for preconscious and subconscious influences upon consciousness and so on, what we have to affirm is that all of these levels, physical, chemical, biological, psychological, all are sublated into the fullness of what it is to be human. There's something of the conjugate forms of all of these in each one of us. And to account for the fact that I not only raise questions, I also eat, I breathe, I walk on other things besides human beings. On the other hand, if one's hypothetical revisor is not a human being, then one is rather hard put to it to conceive a manner in which the existence of different explanatory genera can be denied, because if he or she is not a human being, then he or she is some other genus. So there are different explanatory genera. So, I mean, basically, it does seem to be a matter of common sense. A human being is not a cat. A cat is not an African violet. An African violet is not just a chemical compound. Chemical compounds are not just electrons. That's the point that he's trying to make. There are these differences in the universe. Are we okay up to this? Okay, the next thing, the only other thing that I want to raise, and it will become more important in the next, in chapter 16, is whether, is the realism of all of this, and I didn't put it in the notes, but the isomorphism of knowing and known will come out in chapter, I'm just going to mention this now, and we'll discuss at some length in chapter 16. The isomorphism of knowing and known will come out as the isomorphism also of knowing and known, or real. But the essentials for that are already set, because the known is being. Being is the objective of the desire to know. And so the known is what I reach when I proceed from experience to understanding to judgment. So the known is being, and being is the real. That's the option that he's taking. Being is the real. That is the real. The real is what I know when I proceed from experience to understanding to judgment. I know being, and being is the real. And that's not just wordplay. It's a set of but I think it's something that it's worth wrestling with for the next couple of weeks, those connections. So it's not just the isomorphism of knowing and known. The known remains immanent to the mind, because the known, because of judgment, is not just immanent to the mind. When you say it is, you're saying more than it's something that I'm thinking about. When you say it is, then the known is being, and being is identical with the real. So there's an isomorphism between the knower and the concrete real universe of proportion. Okay, up to that point. All right, now we move into this wonderful stuff about potency as the ground of limitation, and especially potency as the ground of finality, directedness, dynamism in the universe. So all of this stuff here, individuality, continuity, conjunctions, successions, non-systematic divergence, this is all the fuel for the development of the universe. This is all ultimately energy. And he makes it in this next point here. You'll see the connection between potency and energy. It's hypothetical on his part, but it makes a tremendous amount of sense to me as a non-scientist. But this is all something to do with mc squared, mass times the square of the speed of light. This is all potency, if that's what energy is. Number 13, we get into a little bit of that. Potency is the principle of limitation. Each higher genus, plants, animals, human beings, is limited by the preceding lower genus. All right, so I can never, no matter how adept I may become in these operations of understanding and judgment, I can never let go of the underlying substratum. If I do, I will destroy the very foundations of my being. I can't interfere with the autonomy of my animal functions. I have to eat, I have to sleep, I have to have love in my life, I have to have affection, so on and so forth. It's part of what is there, and the love, of course, can be much more than simply an animal function, but it is built on the fact that I'm an incarnate spirit. So I can't interfere with that autonomy, or I would destroy the very foundation of my being as a human being. Yet on the other hand, the higher forms that make me human, the fact that I can do all of these other things, like understand and judge and make decisions, and so on, they're a higher systematization of these other manifolds that otherwise would be purely coincidental on the animal level, insights, judgments, decisions, and so on. And so they are limited by the materials they organize. If each higher genus is limited by the preceding lower genus, then the lowest genus in the universe, whatever that is, we don't know what it is, but whatever it is, it provides a principle of limitation for the whole universe. And this universal principle of limitation is the potency of the lowest genus, which we may name prime potency. And again, a major transformation of a category that Aristotle called prime matter. Okay, but he's transforming this now into a modern scientific worldview. The potency of the lowest genus, whatever it is. So this at the lowest level, okay, whatever that is prime potency. Prime potency, he says, has something to do with energy. It's a stab at this point, I think. But it's something that's always excited me. More precisely, what is needed, he says, is a theory such that prime potency would be conceived as a ground of quantitative limitation, and general heuristic considerations would relate quantitative limitation to the properties that science verifies in the quantity it names energy. And since Einstein, it has identified as mass times the square of the speed of light. So it may very well be, Lonergan's suggesting, that prime potency is what Einstein defined in that equation of E equals mc squared. Now again, this is another example of the nuanced nature of his metaphysics. This assertion, while it makes a great deal of sense, at least to me, and I think it also fits very well within a Teilhardian view of the universe, it is not as firmly established as the general structure in terms of potency form. He's taking a leap. Let's see if this works. Let's see if it makes sense. Okay. Potency and finality. Finality is a notion that is reciprocal to the heuristic notion of being, and it is of equal significance to that. So let's just this number 14 is just a long quotation from page 470. It is not only our notion of being that is heuristic, that heads for an objective that can be defined only in terms of the process of knowing it, but also the reality of proportionate being itself exhibits a similar incompleteness. So this is more about this isomorphism. Okay? The desire to know is incomplete till it gets to judgment, and the reality of proportionate being is incomplete until it gets to these incremental advances of act. Occurrence and existence. It's an isomorphism of very dynamism. So the universe itself, the reality of proportionate being, exhibits a similar incompleteness and a similar dynamic orientation, which in a paper in the third collection he calls the passionateness of being. This dynamic orientation towards a completeness that becomes determinate only in the process of completion. This incompleteness and dynamism are parallel or isomorphic to the heuristic notion of being. Again, quoting him, just as intellectually patterned experience heads towards insights and judgments, so potency heads towards form and that. J. just as cognitional activity mounts through accumulations of insights to higher viewpoints, so objective process involves the information and actuation of prime potency, only to uncover a residue of coincidental manifolds, and so mount through successive levels of higher systematization. Just as cognitional activity doesn't know in advance what being is, and so has to define it heuristically as whatever is to be known by intelligent grasp and reasonable affirmation, so objective process is not the realization of some blueprint, but the accumulation of a conditioned series of things and schemes of recurrence in accord with successive schedules of probabilities. Just as cognitional process is the becoming known of being, so objective process is the becoming of proportionate being. Indeed, since cognitional activity, this whole thing here, is itself but a part of this universe, so its heading to being is but the particular instance in which the universal striving toward being becomes conscious and intelligent and reasonable. That's a breathtaking statement. Cognitional activity is but a part of the universal being. Its heading to being is the particular instance in which the universe's heading to being becomes conscious and intelligent and reasonable. Such is the meaning we would attach to the name finality. Finality is a theorem of the same generality as the notion of being. This theorem affirms a parallelism between the dynamism of the mind and the dynamism of proportionate being. Finality is not some pull exerted by the future on the present. That's a mythic notion. I mean, it's fine in literature and poetry and so on, but it's trying to make it a scientific notion. There's no evidence for that kind of affirmation. It is the process, the restlessness, the fluidity, the tension, the passionateness of being. As the theorem of finality regards present reality in its dynamic aspect, so it affirms this dynamism to be open. As what is to be known becomes determinate only through knowing, so what is to be becomes determinate only through its own becoming. But as present knowing is not just present knowing, but also a moment in process towards fuller knowing, so also present reality is not just present reality, but also a moment in process to fuller reality. Pause there for a moment. Now I'm going to pull something in from a couple of other places in his writing. Elsewhere, he doesn't make these distinctions in insight. He will distinguish horizontal, vertical, and absolute finality. Horizontal finality is to the completion of a thing or a dimension by its proportionate end, the end that results from what a thing is. So we could say, for instance, that the horizontal finality of a human being is to know, part of the horizontal finality of a human being is to know being through true judgments, because that's our nature. So we head towards that. Vertical finality is to an end higher than this. And the clearest instance of vertical finality is a theological finality, the supernatural end of the human person. God has created us for God. That is not something that we can reach by our own operation. We can reach that supernatural end only by the addition of something to our own operations called grace. And the potency to that end is what is called an obediential potency. It's not a potency out of which there can emerge the forms and acts that actually will bring me to God. It is rather a potency that can receive obediential potency, that can receive what is necessary as a result of God's grace to bring me to God. It's obediential potency. And then absolute finality is the finality of the whole universe to God. It's a theological notion which we will see something of in chapter 19. So there's an open dynamism in the universe of proportionate being. Its ground is potency, what is known by the intellectually patterned experience of the empirical residue, the dynamic aspect of the real. The universe is not inert, it's not static, it's not finished, it's not complete. The objective ground of this open dynamism is potency for potency. That is to say, all of these things, individuality, continuity, conjunction, succession, non-systematic divergence, the concrete plurality of everything everywhere, okay? Is what is to be known by an intellectually patterned experience of the empirical desert. But the intellectually patterned experience is dynamic. It is experience under some heuristic structure that is derived from the detached and disinterested desire to know. It is experience that is dominated by that desire. The dynamic orientation of such experience, no less than the experience itself, has its counterpart in proportion of being. So the dynamic orientation as a counterpart in proportionate being, namely the dynamic orientation of the potency of proportionate being to full realization. And again, this is another sentence similar to the one we just saw a few minutes ago. Indeed, since cognitional activity is itself but a part of this universe, its striving to know being is but the intelligent and reasonable part of a universal striving towards being. The whole universe is moving towards being. We move towards it intelligently and reasonably, and when we satisfy that intelligible and reasonable reach, we reach being in knowing. In knowing to be. Yes, Sheldon.
Why does he think that this process would ever end?
I'm not sure that he says that it will ever end.
Because it seems to
it's open.
Okay, but it's completely open. So the universe, from what it sounds like here, like from what it sounded like before, we were going to sort of asymptotically approach knowing whatever the being.
Okay, I mean, from the standpoint of from below upwards, which is what he's basically doing now, there's no saying whether it's ever going to end.
Yeah, okay.
From the standpoint of the Christian theology that he will speak about, that each for each one of us it ends, but it will end with complete fulfillment. The Christian theology will affirm that in the vision of God, in which it will be completely fulfilled. Not that, and I think Rahner's great on this, because not that we all of a sudden say, well, I got there, and that's the end of it. But rather, it's an eternal eureka. You know, the image that he's got at the beginning of the book of Archimedes running naked down the street screaming eureka. After Lonergan died, somebody had the image of Lonergan running naked through the streets of heaven screaming eureka. And it's an eternal eureka. We move more and more into the being of God. Further exploration into the stopping dead in our tracks. Rahner's got, you know, he said it's not really true that that hope ends with death, but hope gets transformed into this this constant movement into what we've reached. He's got a wonderful poem. I think it's the 10th volume of his investigations on hope and hope as eschatological. It's terrific. Speculation, of course. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. So finality, then, is the dynamic aspect of the real, and it's directed. It's a directed dynamism. So it heads toward fuller being. It neither denies nor minimizes such facts as entropy, cataclysm, the death that follows every birth, the extinction that threatens every survival. We all know that any worldview that denied those would be not worth paying any attention to. It offers no opinion on the ultimate fate of the universe, but it insists that the negative picture is not the whole picture. For it knows proportionate being as constituted by explanatory genera and species of central and conjugate potencies, forms, and acts. It knows that potency stands in some dynamic direction towards form, that form stands in some dynamic direction to act, that coincidental manifolds of acts stand in some connection with potency to higher form. Just what that dynamic direction may prove to be is a further question, but at least in some sense, dynamic direction is to be affirmed. Some directing of potency towards form and a form towards act. We'll have more to say about this as we go on later. While it is directed, I just want to get through this. While it is directed, it's not determinately directed. It is not headed to some determinate individual or species or genus or proportion of being. It heads beyond all of these. It heads beyond the myriad individualities of the lowest genus, whatever that might be, to the fewer individualities of higher genera, and beyond these again to higher forms and perpetual cycles of change. Finality goes beyond lower genera and species to higher, and if it is halted at some genus, the halt reveals not finality, but the limitations which it endeavors to transcend. There is the beginning here of a category, set of categories that will become crucial in the next section of this chapter, limitation and transcendence. So it's beginning to introduce them at this point, limitation and transcendence. So even if it halts at one point, the halt reveals not finality, but the limitations which finality endeavors to transcend. Even if one cares to assert that finality can go no higher than human being, so that there can be no more complex emergence than human beings, even if you want to, what's the evidence that there can't be? It is clear enough that our unrestricted desire to know provides concrete evidence that the alleged maximum of possibility is not the maximum of aspiration. And we want, our desire to know is in some way a desire to become more than we are. We are potens omnia a fieri because of that. And in the Latin that Aquinas quotes constantly, we are capable of becoming everything through knowledge. So our desire to know is an aspiration to becoming more. This directed but indeterminate dynamism is precisely what we saw in the first five chapters to be an effectively probable realization of possibilities. Potency is an objective possibility of form. Form is an objective possibility of act. Acts are an objective possibility of higher forms or higher acts. The realization of these possibilities is effectively probable, for on the supposition of sufficient numbers and sufficiently long intervals of time, the realization of any possibility will be sure. So how many eons before life, and then before consciousness, and then before humanity, and so on and so forth. It is the unfolding of the imminent implications of the concrete universe, and so it's realistic, finality. It's also universal. It involves both success and failure. It's an imminent intelligibility, it's emergent probability, but now it's called finality. It's an imminent intelligibility operating through the effective probability of possibility. In human affairs, finality does not undertake to run the world along the lines of a kindergarten. It does undertake to enlighten us by allowing our actions to have their consequences, that by this cumulative heaping of evidence we may learn. But even in human affairs, we know that there's failure as well as success. We can learn from our failures, pick ourselves up, and move on. That's all this finality, that can all be explained in terms of potency, form, and act. So all of these things that are so intimate to our own experience. This finality is both nuanced and flexible. It's nuanced, that is to say, it's concrete, it's differentiated, it's various. It will be realized variously in various kinds of being and also in various, like human beings. They pursue it in different ways. Different beings have different limitations, different tensions, different dynamisms, different thrusts toward a fuller future. Just as the notion of being underlies all other contents and penetrates them and goes beyond them, so too does finality, the potency of the universe, underlie and penetrate and head beyond each being that in fact is. And it's flexible. It operates by changes of state, with new probabilities setting up emergent trends for the verification of new classical laws. Even the emergent trend is flexible. It may follow different routes. a lot of what science has determined in terms of the history and the unfolding of the universe are the different routes that this emerging trend has followed. Later compensations making up for earlier distortions. This happens in human life. Nothing is completely lost. So there's also a major flexibility whereby new coincidental combinations provide the materials for new species and new genera of higher systematization. Now, what I want to emphasize is number 20, because this will become extremely important in terms of the discussion in the second half of the chapter on limitation and transcendence. Potency, then, is the ground of both limitation and finality. The real is dynamic in as much as it is incomplete, in as much as it is less than it can be. But act constitutes its achievement. Form determines that what that achievement is. That should be what that achievement is. Only in potency can one discern the principle that refers determinate achievement to some indeterminate betterment. Now, what I want to get here is the tension of opposites, limitation and transcendence, and that is what they will be called as the chapter proceeds. Potency is a tension of opposites. Potency is a principle of limitation. Potency is a principle of moving beyond limitations. It's a tension of opposites. These opposites are not contradictory, nor is finality a contradictory notion. Contradiction arises only when mutually exclusive predicates are attributed to the same object under the same aspect. But there are two aspects, not one, to potency. Its proper contribution to the universe of proportionate being is limitation. Its relation to form and act is that of finality. Now this will become played out, especially as said in terms of limitation and transcendence throughout the universe. But in human beings, there's a law of limitation and transcendence that constitutes our genuineness, our authenticity. To abide in the tension of limitation and transcendence, and not to displace it in either direction, is the key to human authenticity, or the term that he uses probably prior to a lot of his reading of Heidegger, who used the term genuineness. Genuineness is the abiding in the tension of limitation and transcendence, not displacing it in either direction. Karl Rahner will come on and in different categories will say that concupiscence, in a theological sense, is the tendency to displace the tension in one direction or another. And sin is capitulating to that tendency. But what Lonergan is setting up in this chapter is the abiding in the tension of limitation as the key to genuineness. And that these are not opposites, that these opposites, rather, are not contradictory. In my own work, I've distinguished opposites that are contraries and opposites that are contradictories. Contraries are opposites that set up a tension. Tension is to be abided in, it is to be lived in, it is to be acknowledged and recognized and cherished, rather than attempting to do away with that tension, to capitulate to one side of it or another. To capitulate to limitation through, for instance, could be hedonism, would be capitulating to limitation. Capitulating on the side of transcendence would be the denial of the autonomy of the animal part of our body, and so pride. Pride would be the example of transcendence denying limitation, over ambition, wanting too much. And so, anyway, we'll discuss more of that, but he's setting that up now. Here. Do you have any? Yes?
Did you say earlier that finality is emergent probability?
I think that the, do I want to say that it is emergent probability? What I said was, this whole thing, the realization of these possibilities is effectively probable, and so on and so forth. I think it's intimately related to emergent probability. I think that's
So instead of seeing these as an upward flow, this experience, understanding, and judgment, potential form and act, shouldn't they really be like loops? They should be like circular.
And they actually are, because even in terms of cognitive process, when you reach a judgment,
right,
it gives you data for
different experiences that changes
as well. So it's the same thing. Judgments as acts are also potency for the emergence
right.
of further questions, which will give rise to new
experiences.
It's all a loop.
But then going back to that other thing, it would just seem like there would always be more to know. There would always be more being.
I think that's true. You're talking about like his rhetorical use of like an indefinitely remote date when science reaches the complete explanation of that phenomenon. Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah,
it would not even be
a possible thing to hypothesize.
At
because
the most,
we will create new things to know about. As the universe goes on.
I think it's at best a limited concept. Yeah. I agree with what you said.
Because we have to be careful, like, when you talk about creating new things to know about, that can start to sound like idealism, you know?
No, I just think it means that the world is we are co-creators of the world, and creation isn't finished. That's also, the way he started out, it was as if there was a reality out there to know, and that could be mastered. But the way it seems to be at this point is that we are creating that reality. We are creating the universe. The universe is expanding in terms of its content, not just its size, what the universe is, and it would always be so. Why would it not always be so?
Are you saying that we are creating the expanding of the universe?
Well, we are. That I don't know. I have to think about that. I don't know that we are. But it's part of the potential. Not us, not human beings, but this whole human beings in the sense that we're part of this
proportion.
Proportion
of being may be creating at the expansion of the universe in proportion. It may be.
But that's
its unfolding is responsible for the expanding universe. That I think is.
But proportionate being, like, there's, I don't know. I guess what I'm having a problem with is this idea that there is this, like, if I drew it in pictures, that there is this universe of being,
yeah.
And then there is this proportionate being inside that is asymptotically expanding till it reaches, till they become the same thing.
Right.
What this just seems to me is that there is that idea that there is universal being out there is maybe just a myth, and that really what's happening is that proportionate being is all that there really is, and that proportionate being is expanding. Well, it would just keep expanding.
Well, to this point in the book, he's not making any other affirmation than that. He will raise the question in chapter 19 of whether there is transcendent being as well as proportionate being. But up to this point, he's not saying anything else. And being is not to be conceived as the out there,
right?
But
right.
Rather as what is.
Right.
Is not a spatial term.
No, I'm just using. I'm just thinking about a diagram to.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking about a diagram to explain it. That that's what it means.
Yeah. And so I mean, and when he introduced the category of proportionate being, he said, "I want to introduce this category now." In order to stave off the question of whether or not there is a being that there are no data on in this universe unless those data are given. So that would be transcendent being. There are no data on God in the universe unless God gives God's self as part of the data in our experience. Otherwise there aren't. We can, and so he wants to bracket that question for you. It will come up at the end of the book.
It does come up.
But it's not, it's bracket, and so, so far?
So far.
What you're saying, he would be affirming. As long as you're not saying we create the expansion of the universe. Proportionate beings unfolding
right.
is responsible for the expanding universe.
Right.
That
no, I'm going back between what we know and what is. So on our point, yeah, there's always more to know. There's always more being created.
And there's a parallelism in
yeah,
the openness
yeah.
of the two. Then I think you would...
Proportionate being is the universe.
Yeah.
The part that we create is what the ontology of meaning stuff.
And
which is part of being
human
as well.
Cultures and
yeah.
so on. And you know, also ever more sophisticated instruments to help us know scientifically. You know, I mean, only today are we able to do the kind of exploration of Mars, for instance, that's going on right now. Well, that's human intelligence. That's
we create
ourselves.
We
didn't create Mars.
But if we, well, if we damage the environment to
yeah,
the
yeah,
point
yeah.
that new life forms.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's
yeah.
no question about that. That's our responsibility
yeah.
as co-creators.
Yeah.
Absolutely. See the movie as a corporation and see about what's happening to life forms. Through, you know, it's devastating. Yes.
We create ourselves, though.
Yeah, I mean, create in an analogous sense.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Create has a theological meaning about nothing.
Yeah.
We don't do that.
The person we become.
And through, that's always in community, I think. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's always in community, and it's through the interaction with other people who call us forth and, you know, set the conditions. And, oh, we're past
a minute.
Thank you. So we'll finish chapter 15 next time, genetic method and development.
We'll never go back to
a lot of really good stuff.
Well, we're supposed to hate like